Let's return to Romans, going to chapter 14 tonight. In our series through Romans, this is message number 65, entitled Same Difference. We'll be looking at Romans chapter 14, verses 1 to 3. Him that is weak in the faith, receive ye, but not to doubtful disputations. For one believeth that he may eat all things, another who is weak eateth herbs. Let not him that eateth despise him that eateth not, and let not him which eateth not judge him that eateth, for God hath received him. So the last major section of the body of the letter to the Romans is from chapter 12 and verse 1 through chapter 15 and verse number 13. And this large section breaks into two parts. So chapter 12, verse 1 through the end of chapter 13, which is verse 14. And that part of this section gives us what we might call a general exhortation to love. And in the second part, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 14, going through chapter 15 and verse 13, gives us more of a specific exhortation to love. Now, chapters 12 and 13 exhorted Christians to be a living sacrifice. And this comes, as Paul wrote, through refusing conformity to this age and being transformed by renewed or through renewed minds. The renewed mindset, what we learn in that part of the section is humble. It is loving toward church members, toward authorities, toward neighbors, and even enemies. And those responsibilities are brought to bear on us by the end of chapter 13 with Paul's exhortation for urgent action because of the time that we live in. So Paul calls us to wake up out of sleep and to put on Jesus Christ. So as Christians, we can be asleep in this age, but that doesn't mean that waking up and putting on Christ are optional or indifferent matters. And Jesus taught what living in the light of His return looks like. For example, in Luke chapter 12, verses 35 to 38, "Let your loins be girded about and your lights burning, and ye yourselves like unto men that wait for their Lord, when he will return from the wedding, that when he cometh and knocketh, they may open unto him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you that he shall gird himself and make them to sit down to meat, and will come forth and serve them. And if he shall come in the second watch, or come in the third watch, and find them, so blessed are those servants." So Jesus told what living in light of His return, His second coming, should look like. And it should be a state of preparedness, a state of readiness, a state of being readied, a state of urgency, if you will, a state of being awake. Now, Paul put it this way in Titus chapter 2, verses 11 to 14. "For the grace of God that bringeth salvation hath appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world, looking for that blessed hope and the glorious appearing of the great God and our Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave Himself for us that He might redeem us from all iniquity and purified Himself a peculiar people, zealous of good works." So again, while Paul, at the end of chapter 13, shows us that it certainly is possible for Christians to be asleep or to be very drowsy, you might even say, in this present age, that doesn't mean that waking up and putting on Christ is optional. Some of the parables that Jesus told about the return of a master, and they indicate that there's a time of reckoning when he comes. So the master goes away, servants are left in charge, whether it's a vineyard, whether it's a household, several different settings that he told that sort of a parable in. But the master returns, and when he does, there's a reckoning with the servants. What have the servants been about while he was away? How did they live and conduct themselves in light of his imminent return? So knowing the time that Paul writes about and having a sense of urgency reflects the fact that we also know we will have to give an account of our service. And that would certainly connect with what follows, because Paul does refer to such judgment in chapter number 14. So the second part of this section now, chapter 14, it begins there, runs through verse 13 of chapter 15. And Paul moves here from more general exhortations in the first part to more specific exhortations in the second part. And he is specific enough in this second part for us to see that he is addressing particular areas of tension within the churches of Rome. But he's not absolutely specific, so that this part of the letter does have much broader application beyond the immediate issues. In other words, the issues of tension within the church at Rome are not the only issues that would fall under what Paul is saying in this second part. Now, he specifically mentions these issues, three of them, in fact, in this part of the section. One is eating meat or not. The other is observing special days or not. And the third one is drinking wine or not. So those three issues are mentioned. And again, so there's some specifics that Paul gives us about these issues of tension within the churches, but he's not so specific that it would in any way limit what he is saying to only these three issues. Now, one of the ways that we see him not being specific is that we don't find Paul here explicitly framing these issues as Jew and Gentile issues. He doesn't do that. And in fact, you'd almost would expect him to. Now, it does seem when he's talking about the observance of days, which would have to do with Sabbaths and feasts and new moons, that certainly has a very Jewish flavor to it. But the eating of meat and the drinking of wine don't really fit into that category commonly. So Paul certainly had an opportunity that he could have framed this in terms of Jewish and Gentile tensions within a church, but he doesn't do that. And I think it's important that he doesn't do that, because it gives us enough generality that we know that this has broader application beyond just these three problems. And when he refers to the persons that are in tension here in the church at Rome, he calls them the strong and the weak. He doesn't say Jews and Gentiles, the strong and the weak. Now, the truth is that there are hundreds of situations and issues, and there are varying degrees of strength and weakness, so that really we have unlimited opportunities for conflict and contention with our brothers and sisters in Christ. But remember that Paul is driving toward this great climax in chapter 15, verses 5 to 7. Now the God of patience and consolation grant you to be like-minded one toward another according to Christ Jesus, that ye may with one mind and one mouth glorify God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Wherefore, receive ye one another, as Christ also received us to the glory of God. Now, obviously, that's what Paul is driving to. It's what he has been driving to since he started back in chapter number 12. But now, especially since we've gotten to this part of the section, which is the final part of it, Paul is driving toward this issue, that he wants those members of the church body to be like-minded, such that with one mind and with one mouth, they glorify God, that they live and exist in such a unity and a harmony that it glorifies God. That's what Paul is driving toward. Well, the question for us, particularly in this part of the section that we're looking at, is how can such a diverse group of people with such differing and even opposite opinions, for example, eat or not eat, how can they be like-minded and both glorify God? Well, that's really the question that confronts us as we start into this part of the section. And oftentimes, whenever there are such contentions over these kind of differences, like what Paul is addressing, one group doesn't think that the other group is even capable of glorifying God because of their views or their actions on the matter. Or we could simply say that they think that of each other. They have such a strong difference on some issue that they don't even see how the other group could even possibly be pleasing God by the things that they're doing. Well, Paul's answer in this closing part of the section actually may surprise us. I'm just going to say that Paul does not answer, approach, or handle this situation the way that we typically do. He doesn't do that at all. Somewhat surprising. For instance, Paul doesn't say, well, the meat eaters are right and the non-meat eaters are wrong, so everybody should just eat meat and get over it and get on with life. Paul does not say that at all, in fact. Quite surprising. We might expect that he would. Instead, Paul commits what I call equal opportunity offense. He gives enough in this, the way he handles this situation, so that everybody can find something to be upset about and to be uncomfortable with. So verses 1 to 3 now open this part of this section. And these verses really orient us toward Paul's approach to this whole problem facing these churches in Rome. He first here mentions the weak, and implicitly he mentions the strong because they are the contrast, and he will say the strong specifically throughout the passage. He also immediately in verses 1 to 3 specifies the root problem of what he calls here doubtful disputations, of which eating meat or not eating meat is an example, or it's at least one species of that. And he bases his answer, in fact, he does it more than once as we work through this whole part, he bases his answer to these problems on a greater theological reality. Now, this is the shape of his argument in this entire part. In other words, what he says here in verses 1 to 3 essentially just gets repeated, echoed, amplified, expanded as he moves all the way toward the end of this section in chapter 15 and verse 13. And he will obviously expand. He will obviously give explanation. But what he has to say, we can see basically here in verses 1 to 3. So we're going to look at this first opening paragraph here tonight, verses 1 to 3, where Paul says to receive the weak. Verse 1. Him that is weak in the faith, receive ye, but not to doubtful disputations. So Paul begins here with a general exhortation that gives us key terms to understanding what follows. And you'll see at the heart of that statement, right about the middle of it, is his exhortation to receive ye. Now the word means to take as one's companion or even to receive them into your home. So contextually in this letter, and particularly in this section, we understand Paul to be saying to welcome these into your fellowship. Welcome them into your midst or into your company as he's addressing a church. And by using this word receive, or it could even be translated as welcome, Paul is commanding us to do something more than merely being on speaking terms. By saying receive them, He's telling us to do something more than just being able to nod at one another as we pass on the street. Again, receive them into your company, into your fellowship. Welcome them. Be accepting of one another, in essence. But who is to be received? And what are the conditions of such receiving? Well, first of all, as he starts this verse, the one to be received is him that is weak. Those who are weak. In fact, he says, the one who is weak in the faith. Now, Paul is clear in this part of the letter for us to know what he means. In other words, as we read through this section, it is certainly clear what he means. But it does also help us to consider a parallel passage. And in this case, that parallel passage is 1 Corinthians chapter 8 through chapter 10. Now, that's a section where Paul is dealing with a similar issue, not the same entirely, but a similar issue, especially he's dealing with the issue of eating meat that was sacrificed to idols or not. But if you read 1 Corinthians chapters 8 to 10, which would be certainly good to do during this time that we're going through this part of Romans, if you read those chapters, you're going to notice that there are quite a number of obvious parallels to this passage. Now, there are also some important differences between the two passages, and those differences also are helpful to us in understanding here at Paul in Romans 14 and 15. Now, in the letter to the church at Corinth, Paul was writing to a church who was divided over the issue of eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols, whether when they went down to the marketplace and they bought meat that was for sale there, oftentimes that meat had been used in some sort of pagan sacrifice, and then the remnant, whatever, was brought and sold in the marketplace, and some would buy it, eat it. And there was a problem within the church at Corinth. They were divided over whether that was right or wrong. Should that be done or not? Now, they were divided over a lot of other things as well, but in that particular part of the letter, he's talking about that issue. And Paul also uses the terms strong and weak in those chapters to talk about those on different sides of this issue. Now, he refers to them mainly as strong and weak brothers, but the weak brothers he also describes in verses 7 and 12 of chapter 8 as having weak consciences. Now, he does not use the word conscience here in Romans 14, but he does use it there in 1 Corinthians 8. And he doesn't use the word the faith, weak or strong in the faith, in 1 Corinthians 8, but he does use that here in Romans 14. Now, if you look at 1 Corinthians 8 again, in verse 7, Paul adds a clarifier that those who are weak in conscience lack knowledge. Those who are strong have the knowledge, Paul says, that an idol is nothing in the world, and that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, so that meat belongs to God and not to any sort of fake deity. Well, the strong, Paul says, have that knowledge, but the weak are weak in conscience because they have not that knowledge. Well, what is the conscience? The conscience is a person's moral consciousness of right and wrong. In other words, the conscience is the faculty within a person that reflects what we truly believe to be right or wrong. That doesn't mean our consciences are correct. In fact, our consciences are not morally perfect. They are not infallible. All of our consciences are wrong about something because it is a human faculty that was affected by the fall. So we don't infallibly distinguish right from wrong in our consciences, but within our consciences, we do distinguish right from wrong. Now, Paul, again, doesn't use the word conscience here in Romans 14, but he does refer to the faith, and the definite article is there. He doesn't refer just to faith. He refers to the faith, which is typically a reference to the body of truth that is believed and received by the followers of Christ. So Paul is not talking here when he says the faith. He's not talking about an issue of salvation. In other words, Paul in this opening and throughout the rest of this section, he's not talking about whether someone on one side of this issue is saved or lost. He didn't talk about that at all. And one of the ways that we know that is because he says plainly in verse 3 that God has received the weak and the strong. He makes other statements very similar to that, and some even stronger. So in other words, Paul's not talking about issues of salvation. So they're not weak in the faith that they're somehow barely saved or something of that nature. But again, I believe that it is the same issue as 1 Corinthians 8 to 10, where the weak do not have a properly informed conscience, so that in their conscience, they don't have the freedom to do something that otherwise they should have the freedom to do. So it is an issue of conscience that Paul is discussing in these chapters, issues of differences in consciences. Now, Paul also adds a condition to receiving the weak. He says plainly to receive the weak, but not to doubtful disputations. So the condition for receiving the weak is not to be for doubtful disputations. Well, that phrase means debates over judicial estimates. All right, to put it a little more plainly, Paul says, receive the weak, but not to argue over opinions. That's what he is stating. So what does Paul mean by these estimations or these opinions? Well, we have three examples in this part of that ends that section: eating meat, observing days, and drinking wine. These are three examples that he gives us. But maybe it's not immediately clear to us what the broader category is that each of these three examples fits in. So in other words, how is Paul grouping them, and what else might go in this group of things that Paul is addressing as issues of tension in this particular section? Well, here again, 1 Corinthians chapters 8 to 10 helps us. It's much more extensive. Again, it's not exactly the same. Many differences, or rather many similarities, some differences. But nevertheless, it is very similar. And Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 10:23, the well-known saying, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but all things edify not. So we need to understand the category of all things that Paul's referring to that are lawful to him or permissible to him. And that category would be what these issues in Romans 14 and 15 would fit into. So if we identify the category of where all things are lawful, meaning permitted, we can discern what category Paul's using. All things are permissible cannot mean forbidden things. When Paul says all things are lawful for me, Paul doesn't mean absolutely all. In other words, things like murder and adultery are not permissible for Paul. So he can't mean things that are forbidden by God. So things that are forbidden are not permissible. When he says all things are permissible, he also cannot mean things that are commanded. In other words, Paul can't mean that commanded things like prayer or loving one another are permissible to do, because the not doing of them is sin. So that really only leaves us with one choice. All things are permissible must mean that there is a third category. There are things that God has forbidden in His Word. There are things that God has commanded in His Word. And so the doing of the things forbidden is sin. Not doing the things that have been commanded are also sin. There's no options. There's no choices there. So the third category then would be what we might just call permissible things. Because we can do them or we cannot do them according to our own choice. Just as Paul says about the meat in these chapters in 1 Corinthians. He says, neither eating them nor not eating it is commending you to God. You're not the better or the worse for eating or not eating. In other words, he's clearly saying that they have the freedom to eat, but in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10, he also wants to emphasize you have the freedom not to eat. And sometimes there can be good reasons not to eat. Now again, that's getting a little bit beyond what he's talking about here, but we see that it is certainly the same thing that Paul is talking about. Paul means permissible things, and we can know that from here in the book of Romans, because Paul says that one can eat the meat, another can refuse to eat the meat, and both be received by God. Not only that, he will go on later to even more strongly say that both can glorify God in eating the meat and not eating the meat. In other words, they're doing opposite things. And yet the doing of those opposite things, they can both be received and glorify God. So in other words, what I'm saying is Paul has to be talking about permissible things. These issues of eating meat and observing days, this drinking of wine that he refers to in this passage, has to mean things that are permissible, things that have not been expressly forbidden, things that have not been expressly commanded, but things that we have the freedom and the liberty to do or not do, depending on what may be best. When Paul says, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient, and all things edify not, Paul is clearly indicating there in 1 Corinthians that sometimes there are good reasons to choose not to do something that we may otherwise have the freedom to do. So Paul is obviously talking about things that are permissible here as he's dealing with these issues. Again, it's not issues of salvation. It's not issues of the gospel such that one of these groups is believing a false gospel and one of these groups is saved and the other is not. It's nothing like that at all. Both are received by God. Both glorify God. Both can do what they do by their own conscience in a way that is honoring to God. That's what Paul says in this whole section. All right, so now let's go to verse 2. For one believeth that he may eat all things, another who is weak eateth herbs. So now Paul goes, verse 1 gives us sort of the general statement that he's going to work from, and verse 2 now goes to the specific issue. A specific issue that was obviously a source of tension within the Romans. It says that the strong and the weak here in verse 2 are contrasted. Now, Paul doesn't yet use the term strong, but he will. The strong, he says, believe that they can eat all things. And obviously the implication there is meat, because that is what is at issue. The weak, on the other hand, he says, believe that they should not eat meat. And he puts it positively. He says they eat only herbs, or the word actually indicates most likely vegetables, some sort of vegetarian type of diet that they are adhering to. Now, from the rest of this context, and again, by comparing this with 1 Corinthians 8 to 10, the issue does go beyond mere taste. In other words, Paul's not talking about an issue of mere taste. In other words, someone that simply doesn't like the thought or the idea of meat. So they don't eat any meat because they don't like the taste of it, or they just don't like the thought of eating meat. And I have known some people like that, and they just eat only vegetables. But that's not the kind of issue that Paul is addressing. In other words, Paul is talking about someone with an issue of conscience, that within their conscience, they have a belief about right and wrong in regard to eating meat or not eating meat. So again, this is more than just a matter of taste or preference, but it is an issue of conscience. So the weak are those that Paul's describing who truly have a conscientious issue with the eating of meat. The strong have a stronger conscience whereby they acknowledge the liberty and the freedom that they have to eat the meat, and they have no problem with it. So that is what Paul is discussing. These are issues of conscience that are causing tension because there's a disagreement, even to the opposite extremes, as one says, oh, we've got the freedom to eat, and another says, no, we can't eat that because there's a problem here. Let me come to verse number 3. Paul says, let not him that eateth despise him that eateth not, and let not him which eateth not judge him that eateth, for God hath received him. So now Paul follows in verse 3 with this specific exhortation for the situation. The strong, he says, are not to despise the weak. The weak, on the other hand, are not to judge the strong. Now, the words despise and judge are obviously used in parallel in these statements. Despise means to look down on, and judge means to condemn. So the strong have the freedom to eat meat in their conscience. They have no check. They have no issue there. They have that freedom. They acknowledge that freedom, and they enjoy meat with thanksgiving. Their issue toward the weak, though, can be fueled by pride, so that they despise or belittle those who are weak and have a conscientious objection to eating meat. They can belittle them as, oh, well, they're more concerned about their rules than they are the glory of Christ. Then the weak, on the other hand, the weak doesn't have the freedom of conscience in order to eat meat with thanksgiving. Rather, they abstain from that, and they eat their vegetables with thanksgiving. And all these things come out later in this passage. So the weak doesn't have that freedom. But their issue toward the strong that Paul is warning about here can also be fueled by pride, so that they doubt the very salvation of the strong. In other words, they seem to be so loose and so liberal in their mind, they can't possibly be saved. Or maybe a step back from that, they would view the strong as worldly Christians who cannot possibly be glorifying God in their lives because of the things that they are doing. Now, here's the thing. Paul condemns both of these wrong responses. The strong despising the weak judging the strong. Paul equally condemns both of them here in this passage. And he explains at the end of verse 3, because God has received him. In other words, the strong have a problem receiving or welcoming the weak because they despise, they look down on them, they belittle them. And the weak have a problem receiving the strong because they judge and condemn them as being so much looser than their strict standards. So the strong should receive the weak. And obviously, we think Paul means the other as well. The weak should receive the strong. But each one is tempted to reject the other because of their differing standards of conscience. But Paul points out here, again, moving to that greater theological truth. Well, who's right, Paul? Should we eat meat? Should we not eat meat? Paul doesn't say. Paul says, both have been received by God. Paul, obviously, as you continue working through this passage, obviously Paul leans toward the position of the strong. He doesn't argue as much for it as he does in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10. But his point here is that both of these are wrong to despise and reject, or to judge and reject the other, because God has received them. And the thing is, Paul is saying God has received both with their differing standards or opinions. God has welcomed, God has brought them both in, though they seem to hardly be able to be further apart on this particular issue. Now, one thing that we need to keep clear as we work our way through this part of the section is that the weak are those in this passage who live by stricter standards in this life. But they are not legalists like Judaizers. And that's an important distinction to recognize. The Judaizers in the New Testament demanded works of the law in addition to Christ for salvation. And Paul used his strongest words and his harshest rebukes for those that taught such a thing as that. In fact, calling it another gospel, a false gospel, in fact. Now, Paul is not rebuking these weaker brothers here. They do live by a stricter standard, but they are not like the Judaizers adding to salvation. Now, Paul did one time rebuke a weaker brother. In fact, he rebuked a weaker brother you might have heard of or read about somewhere. His name was Peter, and he was an apostle. And in Galatians chapter 2, verses 11 to 14, he rebuked Peter because his conscientious scruples were affecting the gospel being preached, and they were obscuring it. Now, Peter obviously wasn't as far off as Judaizers. He wasn't preaching the necessity of circumcision or keeping the Mosaic law for salvation. So he wasn't adding legal things to the gospel, but his actions and his scruples of conscience were leading him to give a legal tinge to the gospel. And Paul did rebuke him for that, though Peter in that instance would have been the weaker brother. So clearly, the reason why I point this out is as we work through here, we want to keep in mind that clearly the issues of tension among the Romans hasn't risen to that level. Because obviously, if they had, Paul would have called it out and rebuked it as such. So it's not a Judaizing situation. We also need to keep in mind that differences on these issues are not unimportant. And I think, again, a close reading of 1 Corinthians 8 to 10 will show us that just having the freedom to do something isn't the end of the discussion for Paul. There are other things to consider, and it's not something that is unimportant. So we don't want to think in any way that Paul is trivializing these kinds of issues, because he's not. And he's also not saying that having convictions, and even firm convictions, on these issues are unimportant. And that'll be clear a little later on in the passage as well. So in our Christian lives, we will have to make decisions about doing and not doing certain things that have not been specifically addressed by the Bible. And that's mind-blowing sometimes for some people. I understand that. But there really are issues and situations in life The Bible does not directly address. It doesn't give us a plain prohibition. It doesn't give us a plain command. And it doesn't give us a direct and necessary consequence from Scripture either. And as in our Christian lives, we are going to have to make decisions. We're going to have to make choices about those kind of things. We also have to realize that everybody else is going to have to do the same thing. We all are going to have to make decisions about certain things of doing or not doing them. And so we have to be prepared. If we're just looking out at Paul as he's starting out here and we're anticipating what he has to say in this section, we have to be prepared to receive those, to love those who come to different conclusions on such matters. Again, we're not talking about the deity of Christ. Oh, well, someone sees the deity of Christ a little bit different. They, you know, after all, Jesus was a created being. No, that's not at all what Paul's talking about. He's talking about these kind of issues that are permissible issues, things where we can do or not do, and just the doing of them or the not doing is not in and of itself sinful. So we have to be prepared to realize we have to make those decisions. Everybody else has to make those decisions. And quite often, we're going to come to different decisions. We're going to come to different conclusions about a variety of matters. So we have to acknowledge that we can come down in different places for our lives in these things, but that does not mean that we can hold our brother to the standard of our judgments in these matters, nor does it mean that we can't both glorify God though we are doing different things on the issue. So that's just a little preview of what Paul has for us in this section.